Wondering how to navigate local, city, state, or the federal government in order to grow your business, secure funding for your nonprofit, or advance your organization's agenda? Welcome to Lobbying Insider, a podcast that brings listeners to the intersection of business and government to provide a rare perspective on how things actually get done. We will dive into some pressing current issues, provide keen observations from the past, and keep an ever-watchful eye on what's coming next. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Glad to have you with us. And welcome. On this edition, we are going to talk to two individuals who were highly involved in what could have been a devastating strike for school children in New York City. This was happening right before the start of the school year. Let me make our first introductions. Corey, can you start?
Yeah, hi, Zach. How are you? Corey Muirhead, Executive Vice President, Logan Bus Company and Affiliates.
And our own Charles Kapitanakis. Hey, Charles.
Charles Kapitanakis. I've been a partner here for about 17 years. I'm both a CPA and an attorney, and I proudly represent Logan Bus Company, and we're going to talk about a situation that could have been a disaster, but we helped save the city, and kids went to school, and no one felt a pinch.
And Charles, of course, working for us internally here at Davidoff, Hutcher, and Citron. Okay, let me start with you, Corey, because it sounds like we were very close to having a situation at the start of this school year where children literally would not be able to get to school via their bus routes. Tell us where that was and how that almost happened, and how many routes do you guys do, for example?
Sure. So Logan does about 2,000 routes in New York City. We're the largest contractor. And yeah, I mean, we were on the brink. There's no other way to say it. It was around-the-clock negotiations over Labor Day, over the holidays. And, you know, it was a tumultuous negotiations. You know, it's kind of funny to think about. We have a great relationship with the union, long-standing relationship with the union, very cordial. But when it comes down to negotiations, you know, as an employer, you're fighting for the dollar so that you can spend it on property or vehicles or driver training safety or other things. And as a union, you're fighting for the employee. And of course, you know, we recognize that. And it's just, it's that weird dichotomy where it's like, how much can you give while still preserving your business and making sure that you can keep up with inflationary trends and insurance trends and all the things that have continued to creep up in cost over the years. So it was, you know, I've been in this industry for 14 years. It was the hardest contract negotiation I've ever gone through. I deal with three unions. I deal with over 5,000 employees, and I have to say that this one took a lot out of me.
Yeah. And the union is 1181 ATU, right? They represent about half the drivers?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and this is not totally new in the sense to New York, because, right, New York is a union town. You have individual unions trying to negotiate different contracts with the city. You're always hearing about labor relations and trying to get everybody to the same point, Charles. So you have some experience with this just over the years. I mean, it's not new that there are disputes over contracts.
So in fact, that's correct. But this one in particular is incredibly complex. That I'm sure Corey can give you the details when we're done. You got to remember the backdrop is that we as a firm helped negotiate a huge 7-year in total $8.4 billion school bus contract.
Okay.
Just to keep school buses running through the end of this mayoral term. This union negotiation came in sort of on the tail end. And what had been happening in the city is that the Office of Labor Relations had been settling union contracts one by one at certain fixed rates to keep costs down, which frankly I admire as a taxpayer, but and they did a great job. The most notable one being, I think, the Staten Island Ferry got settled after 14 years.
Yeah.
The Commissioner of Labor Relations was incredibly proud of that. This school bus union contract did not have that success.
Okay.
The OLR and other people had been trying to negotiate over years, and then it just didn't happen. The union was demanding things that some were unreasonable, but some were reasonable. We, as a firm, were initially not involved in it because the bus companies have labor council, but it came to a point where there was an impasse, tempers flew, and that's where we got involved.
Okay, and this is roughly 200,000 kids who rely on bus service. Is that fair to say, Corey? And this is not just public schools, but also private and parochial?
Yeah, that's correct. It's 200,000 system-wide, and the union represents about half the drivers. So out of the 10,000 routes, the union represents about 5,000 employees that operate in New York City.
And so when did you get the indication that there was trouble brewing here, that perhaps you – was it just strictly economics? Was it something more that was going on here? Was it just a dollar amount?
Well, I think we have to take a look back at the summer and the extenuating circumstances around just not only the school bus industry, but also the nation, right? So there's a national school bus driver shortage in a post-COVID world that everybody's dealing with. And it's not just school bus drivers in New York City. It's all over. I mean, you could read countless stories from everywhere. And, you know, not even exclusive to school bus drivers either, right? There's Amazon shortages. There's UPS shortages. There's trucking shortages.
There was a workforce shortage, right? People were getting out of the workforce entirely. That's why, you know, we've seen very low unemployment.
And getting your CDL is a pretty rigorous process, right? It's one of the most heavily regulated industries in the nation. So it takes a very long time to backfill that because it takes, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks for a person to go and get their CDL. So with that being said, it's summertime. Labor is as a general feels emboldened, right? There's the UAW strike. There's some Teamster activity. There's the writer strike. There's just everything. And it's because inflation was skyrocketing.
Right.
And just all the other things that were going on in the world that, you know, it cost a lot of money to live now.
And coming out of COVID, just by background, they printed a tremendous amount of money. It was a 100-year pandemic. People can agree or disagree on whether or not that was a good idea, but sure. I'm no economist, but when you print money, it leads to higher inflation, right? So that costs were going up for everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
it also reduces people's incentive to work.
Right. When you give people money for staying home. Right. Yes, that can do that also.
So
people were leaving the workforce in big numbers.
And combined with that, people would like to stay home and not work and collect and do whatever. But think about a school bus driver. They're up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They're transporting 50 kids on a bus at 6 a.m. I have 2 kids. They're not easy.
Right.
So times 50, yeah. that's a tough job.
That's a well put understatement.
Yeah.
And they have to be on time.
And they have to be on time every day.
Right.
So 50 kids, which means 100 parents, which means so many people that you have to interact with that can go wrong, right?
Yeah.
Not only that, but it's 6 a.m. operating, and then you have the middle of the day off, and then you have the afternoon, and the routes are getting longer, and the streets are getting more crowded, and there's, you know, congestion is not congestion pricing, traffic congestion.
That's a different podcast.
Yeah,
right?
We'll talk. That's a different podcast. But, you know, traffic congestion, it's very difficult to operate big 40-foot school buses in New York City in the five boroughs. So it's a difficult job.
Yeah.
Combine that with the heavy regulation of the industry. I see the union's point where they feel that they need more money.
Yeah.
And that dollar amount is, we didn't agree on, but I understand. We appreciate our drivers. We appreciate our employees and everything that they do and everything that they've gone through and continue to go through as the job gets more difficult. So I understand why labor felt emboldened when we had an existing agreement with the city and there was no collective bargaining agreement. Just strictly from a strategic standpoint, now was the time. Now was the time to call your shot and put out there what you could possibly get.
Right. And again, this is an incredibly complex and convoluted industry. And it's an ever-changing industry. So much so, a couple of years ago, when the Department of Education came up with a plan, which is a right plan, that children should remain in the schools despite where they live, and of course it affected the children who were in different shelters, the companies had to revise, with our help and with City Hall's help and with the Department of Education's help, the different bus routes. So what happened that a child may have started out in the Bronx, then he moved to a shelter in Manhattan, but the child would still have to go back to the original school in the Bronx.
Wow, okay. That is a complicated wrinkle, isn't it?
It's just bizarre. But those are the type of the issues that came along with this thing.
By the way, can I just expand on that? You want to talk about how difficult the job is there.
Yeah.
When we're doing the shelter routes, these drivers are doing routes before their existing routes. So you're talking about a 4 o'clock start, 5 o'clock start, going from Brooklyn to Manhattan to the Bronx. And then you're talking about routes at the at night that don't start until 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So the job is extremely, extremely difficult and lengthy.
How far apart were the two sides, let's say, over the summer? I mean, was it the kind of thing where you were thinking, well, look, where it's just a few percentage points here, we can probably get there. And at what point would you say that it changed and became not a panic, but hey, we're getting really close here as the school year approaches?
So I think what happened is that at one point the union just lost patience and entered into a deal with one contractor that was economically ridiculous. And they knew that, but they had a piece of paper in their hand, and they became emboldened. It was almost, I mean, the rates were almost...
Very high raises and...
Almost double.
Okay,
I mean,
Frankly,
to run a bus company would have been economically unfeasible.
Okay.
It just really was. And that's one of the things that we communicated to City Hall. And City Hall knew that.
Yeah.
And the Office of Labor Relations knew that, and they recognized that, and they as well had their own concerns for their future contracts, because if their future contract contained this, the whole system, pay raise would be, you know, pay system would be out of whack.
Sure.
So it became, toward the end of the summer, it became that. I would say the companies were not in an impasse. I would say the unions were threatening strikes so much so that everybody became really nervous. That's when we got the call.
And there's a high, you know, just to be very clear here, I mean, we're talking about not only kids getting to school, so there's a higher concern here beyond simply economics, but it's a limited amount of resources, right? Because you're dealing with the city that's paying this out. So it's taxpayer money. So yes. It's not unlimited. So while I have a lot of sympathy for the drivers and you want to pay them fairly, it's money ultimately that belongs to the people that they're negotiating.
And think about what it would do to working families, right? They'd have to do, you know, maybe we talked about down at City Hall, giving out Metro cards, Uber, you know, Lyft, that type of thing. And those things work for some, not for enough. But the economic impact there alone and the family work interruption there alone would have been astronomical.
So at what point do you think they started saying strike? You're saying it's after they got this one contract and they realized that it was not coming along fast enough with some of the other operators?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say it would be August.
August. Okay. Yeah. All right. So school starts right after Labor Day?
Yes.
Okay, so where were things, and when did this start to get really tense, where everyone's kind of getting into the room and saying, okay, we're not leaving until we figure this out?
Well, I remember Corey's famous phone call, and I think on a Friday night to me, saying, well, it doesn't look like we're going to have much of a Labor Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But it really happened the 2 weeks leading prior. What the bus companies have, and Logan is just fantastic. For way of background, not only are they the largest operator, but they really are the cream of the industry and consistently not only lead the industry in best practices, but give back. Corey, what did you do the other day? You gave 40 buses for the migrant situation or something like
that?
Yeah,
we did the when they evacuated Floyd Bennett Field because of the 70-mile-per-hour winds, we provided the shuttle buses from Floyd Bennett.
So you guys were there when the city needed that help and assistance?
Yeah, and that's not the time. Only time.
All the time.
All the time, Zach. Yeah. All the time. Different stuff. But the bus companies who are responsible have to prepare. Their drivers have to do training, what's called dry runs, beforehand. And, you know, if there's a strike, people aren't showing up for dry runs and they're not being prepared and they don't know their routes, then there's no way opening day happens. So it's not, you know, opening day may be the Tuesday or Wednesday after Labor Day. It's not in the industry. It happens a couple weeks before.
Okay.
And that's when the wind starts swirling.
Okay. And it got to the point where you're saying where you would sort of have an agreement to delay. I mean, it sounds like you actually didn't have an agreement in place by the time school actually started.
We didn't. We were negotiating every day during the first few weeks of school. I mean, the entire September, you know, luckily Logan has a lot of backfill, right? The operation ran smoothly. The people who handle the operations were able to work under this uncertainty. So kudos to Logan and kudos to the operations team there. But you know, the owner of Logan and myself were in the city or in the negotiation hall that we did out in Long Island nearly every day. And, you know, nonstop bargaining, 10 a.m. meetups to 10 p.m., whatever it took place. So, our entire September was spent negotiating. And, you know, I want to say one of the things that really makes me laugh, but I understand it from negotiating and a labor standpoint, is the problem with negotiation is often that when the unions hear no, they think that it's a flat out no. They don't realize that every half a percentage point or every different economic issue is tied back to a financial model that needs to be reworked and recalibrated.
Right.
And there are many sessions where we were going in there and we were trying to negotiate labor, we were trying to go wages, we were trying to negotiate some health and welfare percentage points. And, you know, obviously any negotiation, you're moving from one pot to the other. And they got very upset because we would say, we have to go back and model it. And it's like, what are you talking about? It's a percentage point or two. And that one percentage point could potentially mean $7,700 per employee. And I'm giving you that as a perfect example because that's one of the things. So when you really get into that nitty gritty, rough negotiation, you have to explain to them, hey, everything you're saying and everything we're saying, when we're putting it on the paper, there's dollars and cents associated with
there's a huge fallout and it's a much bigger blast radius.
Yeah.
Okay.
And exactly. And everything that we say and everything that we move and we do, we calculate to make sure that we could pay for it. We calculate to make sure it works in our model. So we can't just sit here and say, you want three, I want two, let's settle on 2.5. It doesn't work as simple as that. There's too many different circumstances that this affects. It's a domino effect when you get down to the heavy economics of the deal. So a lot of the time was spent explaining that. A very large portion of the time was spent on the wage grid, on how to make a school bus driver a career again. And we heard that Latin career from the union and we respect it and we wanted to make it a career again as well. You know, with a wage grid, it comes years of service, top pay, incentivized bonuses when you reach top pay, certain step escalations to get you there and things of that nature. With step escalations and with the increasing in years comes a lot of money per year and compounded year per year. Explaining that notion and explaining how a wage grid has a ripple effect for future years that you can barely model right now was a humongous overcoming.
Okay.
Credit to, I'll give her a shout out because it'd be funny. I hope she listens. Credit to Carolyn Rinaldi.
Yep, she's great.
She's chief of staff of ATU, old TLC, very, very smart woman. She got it, helped us convey it to their side to get through the dance and land the plane. So, you know, another thing that Charles mentioned before that I think needs to be mentioned, this is taxpayer dollars, right?
Right.
And not only is it taxpayer dollars, but when it comes to increases for government contracts, they're governed by, in our contract specifically, CPI. So it's a CPI increase per
Explain
year.
CPI.
So it's Consumer Price Index. So the way that the mechanism for us to get an increase per year is it's based on the May, June CPI at the end of the year, at the end of the school year.
Okay.
We don't get just a carte blanche increase. We don't go to the city and say, hey, we need 10%. It doesn't work that way. These are fixed contracts. Year over year.
There's limits, right?
There's limits.
Yeah.
And, you know, often, more times than not, the expenses and increases that we give to labor far exceed the CPI increases. And explaining that to City Hall and OLR and explaining it to the union.
Office of Labor Relations.
Yes, mm-hmm. is sometimes difficult, but they understood it. They understood it very well.
Take us into those final hours. Okay, Charles, you mentioned this before, that you actually were about to settle this, right? Sure. And then it kind of blew up at the last minute, and then you didn't even really have a final settlement until about a month later.
So you got to remember, the union wanted to strike. They wanted to announce a strike in August. We would meet. I give Michael Tornabi all the credit in the world because once they showed the owner of Logan showed up and was there, like Corey said, for the entire day, then the gravitas and myself and when I was there the entire day, once the two of us showed up, they realized, you know, that we were interested. And then we got them to back off and just open up in school as we continued to negotiate and planned negotiating strategies on a Friday. Then we got them. I in particular pleaded, please don't strike on 9/11. It's just terrible look.
Yeah.
You know, but instead we negotiated there and visited the St. Nicholas Shrine, right, Corey?
Sure.
On a break. But it came to a point over sort of in mid to late September where all, and I got to give Corey and the others credit for crunching all the numbers because it's unbelievably convoluted.
Right.
Where all the numbers were worked out. And we sat around the table and we went over the particulars of a deal and agreed on everything. but glossed over, if I may, I'm trying to be kind here to both sides, glossed over certain language.
Okay.
And
in the final agreement.
In the final agreement. So when everybody shook hands, stood up, and one person said, we forgot about this language, the union went nuts.
Okay.
Ballistic.
Nuts. Yeah.
Pounded. I've never seen anything like this.
Really? Cursing, screaming.
Listen, I've dealt, like I said.
Emotions are running high, right?
Emotions are running high. The heavy lift is done.
Right.
The economics and the 40 people on the other side know what they are going to be making extra per week, know when they're going to be getting health insurance faster, know if their pension is going to increase. All the things to go home and tell their wives or their husbands, hey, we got this, is done.
Sure.
It's done. The deal from the economic side is done. To then be told that there's a language issue holding up an entire contract did not bode well.
Right.
I mean, the drama was amazing. It would have made a tremendous movie scene.
Yeah.
So I'll give...
you're all kind of locked in a room together here.
Oh, and, yeah.
Oh, no. There was no more locking in.
Right.
The union walked out and got the strike signs.
Okay.
After, forgive me, I misspoke. After pounding on the table and some choice language.
Yeah.
Shall we say.
Okay.
Right. And here I'll give Tomas Frett credit.
Tomas Frett's the president of 1181.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. Well, Corey, you tell the story. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's your story to tell.
Well, it's just, I've never seen. So what I said is that we are going to put a pin in this thing right now.
Yeah.
We have an agreement. We've agreed on everything. And we will come back somewhere down the road and talk about language. And that's it. But we're agreed. And it took that a while. To get through.
Yeah,
maybe it's because it's, I don't know, ancient Greek philosophy and you're Greek, but you were very stoic and you practiced quite a bit of, you know, stoicism there. It would not have gotten done without you. The ability to assess both sides of the situation.
You didn't see the sweat rolling down my back.
But the ability to assess both sides of the situation, to know that we both wanted to get it done.
Right.
And this was an ego thing, right? That's kind of what it boiled down to a little bit. You know, the language is important, of course, right. But sitting there day in, day out, financially modeling everything, understanding, getting a good deal for labor for 5 years of labor peace and bringing, you know, a sort of cachet back to the industry that this is a career and providing health benefits and an accelerated path so that people in a crazy post-COVID world can really feel comfortable with the health and safety of their family and kids. We were done. So for that to all be jeopardized by language was a difficult pill to swallow for everybody. The fact that you were able to calm the situation down, assess it, not let it blow up, you know, was heroic.
And then that didn't get settled for another several weeks, right?
It was just language, Zach.
It was just language.
Right.
So it got
right.
settled down the road.
Listen, okay.
Thank you. Very kind of you to say, but we here practice that way, Corey, all the time. You know, we take it cues from Sid. Sid Davidoff, who just, you know, listen. A bunch of us were in government. I myself was a former clerk of a federal judge. We know when to push government and when not to. We know we never recommend anything that government won't agree to. It'll hurt our clients. It'll hurt that. So we know when to stop and take a step back and try to come up with a best solution, rather, for everybody, especially in this case for these kids.
And in terms of the lobbying angle, how essential is that and those relationships, right? Because the lobbyists tend to be sort of behind the scenes in all of this. You got two sides trying to bargain and come to an agreement, but the go-between, I think, is a key part of all of this.
I would say, if I could answer this, Charles, I would say it was paramount. And the reason it was paramount is because, remember, yes, we provide a service. We're an essential service to New York City.
Right.
We're an essential service to the families, but we're a for-profit entity.
Yeah.
So there is a stigma attached to that, regardless of what service you provide. It is what it is. We're not here to debate that. The ability to convey the for-profit contractors' messages across and understanding of the situation that they're in to government is so important so that you have a story to tell and they understand your side. And we couldn't do it. We could not do it without Charles and Sid.
Right.
And the ability to continue to go through the government channels and, you know, credit to the mayor's office and credit to the Office of Labor Relations for really sitting, giving us an audience, right?
Big time.
Giving us an audience, asking the right questions, pushing us when we needed to be pushed, taking a seat when they needed to take a seat, and just overall wanting to be informed and stay in the know. And then obviously credit to you and Sid for informing them with the knowledge that they needed to be, you know, a part of this to land this plane again. So I think that it would not have gotten done without the intervention of the mayor's office and OLR, mm-hmm. but subsequently it would not have gotten done with just labor councils fighting back and forth. There was too much bad blood there.
Right. And so, and both sides have a vested interest in doing what's best for their either respective company or their members, right? Sure. I mean, so it's not necessary. I mean, in some respects, you can lose sight, I think, in an intense negotiation of the greater good, which is sort of what I wanted to bring this to. I mean, we're talking about kids getting to school here,
great point,
right? So it's a very, this is not just some run-of-the-mill contract negotiation. This involves actual kids and school.
Great point.
Great point.
Yeah. And so do you think that that was kind of brought aware in the moment, or do you think that people had to kind of take a step back and say, hey, listen, let's remember here, we're talking about a greater good?
So when the emotions run high, people just sort of forget where they are.
Yeah.
What we always try to do from the beginning is focus on everybody. I'm like, let's start school. Let's continue to negotiate. You want to strike? You could always strike. But let's get the families, you know, get the kids to school, get their families' lives in order. Let's get a good school year. Let's get a good rhythm. And we worked very hard with, as Corey said, with the Commissioner of Labor Relations, Renee Campion. She was fantastic.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yep. And the mayor's office. We got called into the principal's office. Don't get me wrong.
That is true. That's for sure.
Right?
By the way, it takes a lot of massaging. You know, that's the leverage the union has at that point, right? Is that they have to strike because we're at the wit's end, we're at impasse, or we're not moving. So for them, what other negotiation tactic do they have other than to strike to get what they wanted from the contract negotiations? So the fact that, and again, we're throwing out a lot of credits here, but, you know, credit to Tomas Rett, credit to Michael Cordiello. Tomas is the union president now. Michael was the previous union president who was still involved in his negotiations. They did recognize, sometimes after emotions run high, they did recognize the greater good.
Okay.
So the continued contract negotiations while they opened school and that message massaging that we had done, they recognized it and they understood. And that's why it took a while, because we were moving, and each time we were moving, we would quote unquote buy another week, and we'd make a significant dent in the contract negotiations and the economic package, and we would do another week. And we'd all leave happy because we knew that we were getting closer to the end goal.
Right.
And that was extremely important, to show that faith. And we all trusted in each other, right? Like it was a leap of faith that we kept going weekend. Hey, we're giving this. We just let's take a step back and realize we just negotiated this and this off the board. There's a couple of days in there that might be a holiday. We're going to meet Tuesday, Thursday.
Right.
Let's promise that school's open until September 15th.
Yeah.
And when we would report back, they'd be ecstatic. They'd be happy. And they knew that things were progressing. So it was extremely important to continue that negotiation.
And it sounds like we were very, very close. And I'm not sure that every average parent totally understood the situation we were in. We are coming close to the end here, and I do want to wrap it up, but I did want to ask what's coming next, Corey, for Logan. My understanding is you're going to make a big investment in clean energy.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much, Zach. Logan Bus put the first 5 electric school buses on the road in New York City. They're operating in Brooklyn and Queens right now. They're great. We love them. We really want to become the first electric fleet in New York City. The state and the city have a climate goal of 2035, and we're hoping that we could beat that timeline. Obviously, we need to invest a lot. We need help from, there's the Clean EPA School Bus Rebate Program and the Clean Bond Act with New York State. But we're there. You know, we're involved in everything. I sat on the NYSERDA Electric School Bus Advisory Board to talk about how the state altogether can come as one and electrify. But Logan really wants to be the forefront in the industry like we are. And we're going to make some significant investments in electrification.
You forgot to mention that you and Logan were honored by the League of Conservation Voters.
Yes.
That's a big honor in that sustainability community,
right? That's
big shout out, Julie Tai. Very, very big advocate for electric school buses. And the Bond Act was a tremendous get, not just for school buses, but clean water and just overall environmental policies in New York State.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much, Charles, Corey. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lobbying Insider is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York's premier middle market law firm, practicing in over 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and, of course, government relations. The Lobbying Insider is produced by Joe Benti, and our sound recording engineer is Devontae Addison. Publicity by Jody Fisher PR with Beth Ann Mayer at Lemon Seed, creative managing social media. Our podcast platform manager is Monica Thomas. I'm Zach Fink, host of the podcast, and if you'd like to help us spread the word about our show, please share it with colleagues and friends, and be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice. It can be found on Apple, Audible, Google, iHeart, Podbean, and Spotify platforms. Thanks for joining us.